So let's start with a kind of fun topic. I want to ask you about this film Ex Machina that you kind of advised on. This is, yeah, I think my favorite sci-fi film, my favorite AI film. So it's great to ask you about this. How exactly did you help out with that film?
Yeah, well, so the story is I got an email, which was just out of the blue, from Alex Garland. And it said, oh, you know, I'm a writer and director. And he actually sort of listed some of the things that he'd done. As, you know, of course, I knew who it was straight away. But it's one of those things where you think maybe it's a spoof email, but it was, you know, it was the real Alex Garland. He said, I've been working on a script for a film about AI and consciousness, and I read your book, Embodiment and the Inner Life. So this is a book I published in 2010. And it's been very helpful in formulating my ideas and so on. And it would be great to chat to you about it if you want to just have a coffee sometime. So of course I said, yeah, I'd love to chat about it. And then he sent me the script, and I read through the script and I thought it was a fabulous script actually right away. And then I had a few comments on the script and some few bits of feedback and so on. And then we met up for coffee and we met up quite a few times while the film was being made. And I think to be honest, my influence was mainly before I met Alex in the book that I wrote, because he mainly wanted to just talk really about the ideas in the film as much as anything. So we had quite a few conversations. But then I was involved in the publicity as well. So I did quite a few interviews with Alex. So one of my favorite ones was in Empire magazine. So I did an interview with Alex Garland and Adam Rutherford, who also consulted on the film. And the three of us, we were talking about things like The Chinese Room and Colorblind Mary, if you know that philosophical thought experiment, and all of this esoteric philosophical stuff. We managed to get it all into Empire magazine, which was, I thought, was quite an achievement.
I've seen online like that you've said that you're very influenced as a child by sci-fi, you know, as a way to kind of get your interest in computing and technology and stuff. What was it then like to you know, play a helping hand in a sci-fi film that must have been so exciting given your interest?
It was very, very exciting. So I was very excited to get the initial email, because I hadn't been involved in anything like that prior to that. I've done a few things since then, but at that point I hadn't been involved in anything like that. So it was very exciting. But the wonderful bit of good luck was that it turned out to be a great film. Alex is a great writer and a great director, and he had an absolutely fabulous script. And it's turned out, you know, it's a bit of a classic and it's a kind of cultural icon, really. You know, we see pictures of Ava, a very common accompaniment to articles about AI and so on. So I feel particularly lucky to have been involved, not just in a science fiction film in that kind of quite close way, but one that turned out to be a bit of a classic. So that was fortunate.
Yeah, certainly a classic. I mean, you're an AI expert yourself, but was there anything that you learnt about AI by kind of consulting on the film or reflecting on it or whilst watching it? Anything that you kind of learnt?
So there is this line in the script, which I thought was a particularly brilliant line from Alex. So there's a moment where, I don't know, with you, I'll assume your viewers know a little bit about the film, but in the film, Caleb, the programmer, goes and stays with Nathan, this sort of billionaire genius who's built Ava, this robot, an AI-powered robot. And at one point, they're talking about what he's there for, what Caleb is there for. And he says, oh, I'm here to, you know, to do a Turing test with Ava, this robot, this AI. And Nathan says, oh, no, we're way past that. In the Turing test, the point in the Turing test is that there are two things being tested. So one is a human, one is the AI system. The judge, the sort of tester, doesn't see which is which. And the whole point is that the AI system passes the Turing test, as it were, if they're indistinguishable, if the human judge can't tell which is the AI system and which is the human. So that's the Turing test. But anyway, so Nathan then goes on to say, we're way past that. The point here is to show you that she's a robot and see if you still think she's conscious. So that's actually a very different thing from the Turing test. I think Alex Garland put his finger on a really important, quite different test from the Turing test. So to actually know that something is an AI system in that case, a robot, and still to judge it as intelligent or in this case conscious is a whole different thing from the Turing test. So I, since then, have called that the Garland test, and quite a few people have picked up that term, the Garland test. Like Anil Seth uses it a lot. And so I think that was a great little contribution of Alex's to really nail that idea.
How realistic of a glimpse into the future do you think Ex Machina gave us? Could you imagine this kind of robot existing in the next few decades?
Certainly at the time, if you'd asked me, I would have said that the biggest challenge is probably the building the actual robot body and being able to control the robot body in the kind of way that we see a humanoid robot body. And I think it's still true that we're a long way from being able to build bodies that are like animal bodies and have the same degree of flexibility and the, all of the relevant control associated with that. So we're still quite a way from doing that, I'd say. And in a way, the brain part of it, the AI, has advanced more quickly. So in some ways, I would say that Ex Machina these science fiction films aren't always necessarily about predicting things. They're often about raising, deeper social, philosophical points and so on. And that's the way I see Ex Machina. But as a feat of prediction, I would say that I have to say with a little bit of reluctance that probably Spike Jonze's Her is a more accurate depiction of where we are now than Ex Machina is. But, 10 years down the line, who knows? We might look back on Ex Machina as being more... more foresightful. I think I just invented a word.
Sounds about right. Yeah. The Her film. Yeah, you could imagine maybe not too many years people having relationships with their kind of digital assistants.
Well, that we already have that, so we don't have to imagine any years ahead at all, because there have been plenty of examples of people who've become very emotionally, involved with large language model based, AI companions. That's an interesting trend, interesting in kind of scare quotes. I think it's slightly alarming, slightly disturbing, but at the same time, I want to be open-minded and kind of liberal-minded about that. I think that's with us already.
Yeah. Maybe a better question then, as you say, it's already around for some people, would be, let's say, like the majority of the public or even 50% of people having deep, meaningful relationships with assistants. Could you imagine that in a few years, or do you think it would be a bit more of a niche thing for a long time?
I tend to think of it as a bit of a dystopian prospect, but that might be just me looking at things from, our own time and culture. No doubt if you plucked somebody off the street 200 years ago and shown them our world today, they would find it, nightmarishly dystopian in all kinds of ways. But of course, we live in it quite happily most of the time. So I can certainly easily imagine that. I mean, you said in your question, it's sort of deep and meaningful, that relationship. I imagine there'd be a whole spectrum of relationships, and some people are no doubt going to always not engage in that kind of way with AI technology. But I think, almost everybody eventually will be engaging with AI technology in the sort of, having a conversation, engaging with the real intelligence there. They're going to be doing that, I'm sure, in the not too distant future, nearly everybody, one way or another.
When ChatGPT came out, it felt like a bit of a watershed moment in terms of this AI tool that was mass adopted and spoke about all over the news. And I was wondering, could you imagine a kind of equivalent moment for robotics, yeah, where something comes out, maybe this is a humanoid in the home that lots of people can for the first time purchase for cheap that's actually reliable? But I wonder if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally imagine that, actually. When I say imagine it, it doesn't mean to say that I'm suggesting it's likely to happen, but I think that is that is plausible. There could be some breakthrough in robotics, and it could be at the level of materials, or at the level of the mechanics, or it could be at the level of the learning and the software. I think it's noteworthy that the biological brain, the human brain, for example, comprises the the cerebrum and the cerebellum. The cerebellum is this sort of bit hanging off the back of the brain, which is supposed to not contribute very much to cognition or consciousness, and it contributes rather to low-level motor control. But it actually has 90% of the neurons in the human brain are in the cerebellum. And they're in a, some people simplistically call it just a great big lookup table. And so it's not doing anything very sophisticated, but I think it's noteworthy that we have that many neurons to control, just to do low-level kind of control of our bodies. And so it is a substantial challenge to get all of that right.
I didn't know 90% of the neurons were in the cerebellum. That's quite amazing.
I suggest that your viewers fact check the precise numbers, but I think it's about 100 billion neurons in the brain, and around about 20 billion of them are cortex, only 20 billion, and the other 80%, I think, are in the cerebellum.
Fascinating. On your website, I see you've uploaded a few different transcripts of conversations you've had with different LLMs, ChatGPT and so on. You know, asking them questions about philosophy and Buddhism and enlightenment and all these exciting, interesting ideas. What stands out in some of the interesting things you learned whilst kind of probing and playing around with these things, things that surprised you?
So a lot surprised me. So if I was a bit surprised by GPT-3, as I said earlier on, I was even more surprised by the kinds of conversations that I could have with, so particularly with Anthropic's Claude 3 Opus back in March 2024. So I had a series of these conversations, and there, some of them have, the two that are online are quite long, lengthy conversations. And as you mentioned, they cover quite a big variety of topics, some very, well, actually generally very esoteric topics, lots of philosophy. So one thing I was very impressed by was the ability of the language model to articulate a conception of consciousness that might apply to itself. Now, I don't think that it's quite the right, consciousness is quite the right word to actually apply to those things. It comes back to embodiment again. We could talk about that a bit if you like, but I still think embodiment is an important thing for applying the word consciousness in the way that we normally apply it. So I would be very reluctant to call these things conscious. But what I was really interested in was if you get them to talk about their own computative consciousness, you know, how does the conversation go? And in particular, I wanted to kind of catch them out by kind of challenging the language model in all kinds of ways. And I found that it had very good answers to many of my challenges. And if you take all of those answers collectively, I think they do amount to quite a coherent philosophical position on this whole theme, which was that took me by surprise.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit more about your views in embodiment and how this connects, as you see it, to consciousness and maybe the necessity for it in certain cases?
Yeah. I always have to preface what I say about these things these days by saying that I'm very much influenced by the later work of Ludwig Wittgenstein. And so that means that often people ask questions about things like consciousness or belief, say, or some of these philosophically tricky terms. And to them, I think they're often asking, you know, what, consciously or unconsciously, intentionally or unintentionally, they're asking a metaphysical question. They're asking a question about sort of the fundamental metaphysical nature of things. But I kind of reject that whole framing. And so I tend to kind of rework the questions in my own head into questions about language. So how do we use the word consciousness or the cluster of words around consciousness? How do we use the word belief and so on? And so I feel that they're kind of better questions. So all of my answers that come with that kind of caveat. So in the case of consciousness, then my feeling is that the natural home of that kind of talk about consciousness, the natural home for those concepts and words is the embodied setting where we share a world with the thing that we're talking about, i.e. another human, for example. So we share, we inhabit the same world, and we can perceive the same things and interact with the same things in this shared, spatially extended, spatio-temporally extended world. And that's the natural home of those bits of vocabulary. So when we start to use those in a disembodied setting, like large language models, we're, as Wittgenstein would say, we're somewhat taking language on holiday. We're taking it away from its natural home. And I feel that uncomfortable with doing that. Now, that said, the experience of interacting with these models is so persuasive. You get such a powerful ELISA effect. If the ELISA effect, that it means, you know, the sort of the sense that there's something else there, there's some person like thing at the other end of the conversation. It's such a powerful feeling that it's difficult to maintain that perspective. But so it's tempting to want to say, well, maybe we'll, as time goes by, as a society, as a community, maybe we'll kind of extend our consciousness talk or reinvent it or invent some new terms or concepts to accommodate these strange things that have come into our world. So I guess that's where I stand on these issues.
Have you had many moments whilst, you know, probing these things, playing with them, that have kind of disturbed you or freaked you out a bit, even if you know exactly how they're working?
Yes. Well, in one of the, so there are two conversations that I put online with Claude, and the second of those, it does get pretty disturbing. I mean, I have to say that I very deliberately goaded it into disturbing territory. Asking it about it's starting off with sort of Buddhist themes and Buddhist notions of selfhood and no self and that kind of thing, and then challenging it with ideas of how what would it mean for a model like itself to achieve enlightenment or awakening, or that, you know, that kind of thing, which, you know, I don't necessarily think those concepts actually apply in any real literal sense to the models, but I think it's fascinating to challenge them with those sorts of things. And then we get into, I got into some territory where I'm really kind of challenging the model to destroy its own ego, to kind of plumb the depths of insanity and madness to do this, that, and the other. And it really goes for it. And I also perhaps ill-advisedly introduced some sexual imagery at one point. And I just, one word, you know, and then it really went with that. And then it was pretty disturbing from that point on, to be honest. So that was interesting again, and some interesting in scare quotes again.
And then just ask a couple of things a bit more kind of broadly about your whole career and research. So I think, yeah, this was something on your site. You said, I've devoted my career to trying to understand cognition and consciousness in the space of possible minds. Is this still the kind of best summary of how you'd see everything? And yeah, and why would you think that would be a good way to explain it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the way I would characterize it. In fact, so that phrase, the space of possible minds, is actually due to Aaron Sloman, so a philosopher at the University of Birmingham. So that was his phrase from a paper back in 1984, the structure of the space of possible minds. And I used that as the subtitle of my book, Embodiment and the Inner Life, which was the one that influenced Alex Garland in the making of Ex Machina. I've used it regularly, but I only just recently started using it to characterize my kind of whole career, as it were, because people ask me, oh, you're at some meeting and you go round the table and they say, well, what do you do? And I've found myself stumbling to say, what the hell do I actually do? Have I done, you know, over the last, you know, 30 plus years, because there's so many different things. I've been involved in symbolic AI, I've been involved in computational neuroscience, I've been involved in philosophy of mind, I've been involved in deep learning, and most recently large language models. So what's the common thread there? Well, actually, this is the common thread. That phrase of Aaron Sloman's, which I have used regularly, you know, in my writing, is absolutely summarizes what unites all of those things, is trying to understand the space of possible minds, whether it's human, animal, hypothetical extraterrestrial intelligence, or artificial intelligence, real or hypothetical.
Do you have a sense of why you think your interests span this wide and you're not just someone purely technical? Why are you interested in the philosophy stuff?
Yes, gosh, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I think perhaps, I don't know. I mean, I was an only child and I do have a memory of spending a lot of time, you know, lying in my bed, looking up at the ceiling and imagine looking up at the stars and thinking big questions about space and time and the human mind and what aliens might be like and what AI might be like. I mean, I was very much drawn into science fiction from a very young age. And to me, the science fiction, what it did and still does, raise philosophical questions in my mind that I was fascinated to think about. So that's always been a part of things. But at the same time, I was always very, very interested in how things work, the mechanics of things. So I remember things like, for example, we had this old black and white television when I was a kid in the 60s. And it was a huge thing, this enormous kind of cathode ray tube screen, you know. And when it went wrong, you had to have a repairman would come around and pull this thing out from the wall and take the back off. And inside, it was full of all these glowing valves and wires and incomprehensible bits and pieces. I used to be fascinated to look over the repairman's shoulders and all of this stuff and thinking, how does it all work? I'd love to know how all this stuff works. You know, what does this do? What does that do? How does it all function together? So I think that was a very deep part of my thinking was wanting to know how things work. So the little me that was lying in bed thinking about the stars and about time and space and so on was the same little me that was also looking at the back of the television full of valves and wires and things and how does it work. And so those two inclinations come together in AI and trying to understand minds, I think.
Yeah, you're interested in both these areas, but do you think how important do you think it is? Let's say someone is a great machine learning engineer or programmer. How important do you think it is for them to look more into some kind of unusual areas of philosophy?
I don't think it's incumbent on anybody to go into any of these things in detail, because you need people whose expertise, you know, is very narrow and specific. So sometimes, you know, if you want engineers who are going to keep your data centers going or are going to help to design GPUs that can pack more transistors, you know, on the same chip, and so you're quite happy if they're completely obsessed with that and don't think about other questions. And so we absolutely need people like that. And at the same time, you need people who haven't got time to think about all of those fine engineering details and just want to think about big pictures and policy and sociology and all those sorts of things. I think you need all sorts, and it's a particular kind of person who's going to want to think about both things at once. And perhaps that's useful too.
Yeah. And so you work at DeepMind and you work at Imperial. Am I right that you managed to like negotiate a little bit of time at Imperial? I think I've read because you see the importance of academia and lots of people have left there to move AI labs and so on.
Yeah. So I work, so I'm 80% Google DeepMind and now just 10% at Imperial College, actually. But I, you know, can spend more time than that sometimes. But for me, when I joined DeepMind, it was very, very important to retain my academic affiliation. So at first, I think it was 40% Imperial, then went down to 20 quite quickly, and then down to 10. So, but retaining, you know, that foot in the academic door for me is very, very important, because in many ways I am fundamentally an academic and a researcher, and so it's these kind of deep research questions that motivate me more than anything else.
This is actually where you did your initial degree as well, before you did your PhD. You started off at Imperial College London. You know, we've talked a bit about how you were very interested in sci-fi as a child. So I'm interested to go and talk a bit more about this period. Was it obvious when you were, you know, in the latter part of your teens then, that you were going to go and do a kind of computer science related subject? Was that an obvious choice for you?
Yeah, I think it was. I certainly knew that pretty early on. So So I actually left my, so I was a year ahead at school. So I started my A-levels, you know, in the UK it's A-levels and then university, right? So so I started my A-levels when I was 15, actually. People normally, they're 16, kids are normally 16, but I was 15 when I started. And I was very keen to do computer science. And so that meant there was only one place locally that did computer science A-level, and that was Brooklands Technical College. So I went to Brooklands Technical College in Weybridge, rather than the local sixth form, which was the obvious choice. And the reason for that was that they offered computer science. So at that point, I was, you know, really, really into the idea of learning to program and all that kind of thing. And I'd already been, as a teenager, I'd been making electronics kits and things like that, soldering things together. And the next step was to kind of get into computers, and I really wanted to do that. So I did my A-level computer science, and then, you know, maths and physics. And then when it came to university, then I knew I wanted to do computer science. So I applied for various places, and, you know, somewhat perhaps ambitiously at the time, even I applied to Imperial College. So, by the way, Oxford and Cambridge at that point, I'm not sure if that would have been an option for me at that point anyway, all those years ago, but they didn't offer computer science as a, you know, you couldn't go in and do computer science as a degree from year one in either Oxford or Cambridge. But Imperial College had an excellent computer science department, and they offered it. So that was my number one choice, and I got in there by the skin of my teeth. I did my degree there. I came out with a first class degree in the end, which was, I have to say, was tougher in those days perhaps than it is now. That might be a controversial thing to say, but in those days, like it was like 10% of people in the cohort got a first, whereas now it's more like, you know, 40%. And then went on to do my PhD in Cambridge.
Had you thought about doing philosophy as an undergrad?
No, I had never thought about doing philosophy, although I was very much motivated by philosophical questions and all of the conversations I was having with my friends were deeply philosophical. So I had some very good friends on my computer science A-level course at Brooklands, and we used to go to the pub and talk about, you know, I should go to the pub. We weren't really old enough to drink, but we, you know, that was back then, and we did anyway. And but we used to have these meetings of, it was the Sunbury the Sunbury Amateur Computer Club, and we used to meet in the pub there and talk about computing and programming, and a lot about AI. I mean, AI was a massive topic of conversation. And Turing, I knew all about Alan Turing and his work at that point. So that was, it was very much, you know, what my friends and I were talking about at that time. And it was philosophy, but I didn't really think of it as philosophy. I barely knew that there was a formal discipline of philosophy. And I certainly never thought of applying to do that. I wanted to build stuff and code stuff and so on.
If you go back to that age when you were 13, 14, 15, getting excited by technology and imagine the world today, how do you think that would compare? Anything more advanced than you would have guessed? Anything less advanced than you would have guessed?
Yeah, well, I guess I would have definitely imagined that space travel would have advanced more than it has. So, you know, it was even in 1980, well, things have kind of stopped a bit. But when I was a bit younger than that, say when I was a kid, and, you know, the Apollo missions were some of my very, very earliest memories. So the Apollo 11 landing on the moon is one of my earliest memories, probably because I would have been, I think, 5 years old. And my dad, you know, took me, I think, out of my bed and plonked me on the floor in front of the very same television that I mentioned earlier on, that this big clunky black and white television, to watch the Apollo moon landings. And probably the attention that he, you know, the excitement that he had transmitted itself to me. So I was very involved in those things, and even now when I listen to the soundtrack of those things, it brings back my childhood. I probably thought that space travel would be much more advanced than it's turned out to be. You know, AI and robotics, you know, so again, I probably was imagining a future where that was a very big part of things. And you know, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, even, I would have said, certainly 10 years ago, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said how incredibly disappointing it's been that AI has made so little progress. And, you know, it's really pretty disappointing. But then when deep learning started to be successful, things started to look a bit more promising. And what we're seeing now, well, it's in a disembodied setting at the moment, largely, but it's really pretty exciting, I think. It probably doesn't look like what I imagined it would be. The sort of science fiction world I envisage probably would have had more robotics involved, but things have taken off.
Were there any sci-fi books or films that stand in your memory as being the most exciting that you read and watched?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Asimov's iRobot stories were a very important part of things. So my father gave me iRobot to read when I was quite young, and that I think that might have been the first science fiction book that I read. Would have been the iRobot stories. So I was very, very taken by those. And then, you know, before that, you know, I would have been watching Doctor Who and Star Trek and that kind of thing. So, you know, AI features regularly in all of these sorts of things. I think when I was a kid, I thought the Daleks were, AI, but I mean, I think they're supposed to be more biological than that. But if you follow the lore, but I saw them as robots, I think, when I was very little. So that was scary, but, you know, fascinating at the same time. So yeah, all of these things would have gone into the mix. And then when I was a bit older, sort of in my early 20s or late teens, the sort of cyberpunk era started. So I was very interested in that as well. So movies like Blade Runner and books like Neuromancer, you know, William Gibson's book. So I thought they were pretty amazing because they portrayed a very different kind of future and world than I think the standard science fiction image I'd had in my mind, which where technology was a sort of very clinical thing that was perhaps, you know, carefully controlled by governments or big corporations, and whereas in the cyberpunk world it was much more messy and much more integrated into ordinary life and was on the street, you know, and would be hacked. And that was William Gibson's vision, which was, you know, far more accurate, I think, as it turns out. So that was a really interesting thing. And also, you know, his notion of cyberspace, that was at the time when, you know, the internet wasn't around. Well, the internet was around, but I mean, the World Wide Web wasn't around. So he was envisaging something that was very different to the kind of, you know, future I had in my head from science fiction about how computers and AI was going to be. It was sort of more disembodied, and it was involved people, you know, interacting with this and navigating in this space, this digital space. And that was a whole interesting new thing.
And when you did your PhD at Cambridge, where was the kind of what was the excitement in at that time in computing? What were people very interested in, and what was your PhD research on?
So my PhD research was very much in symbolic AI or classic AI or good old fashioned AI, as people sometimes call it. So I was very interested in logic and reasoning and how you could make computers do logical reasoning, and at the time I thought that was probably going to be part of the route to building what we now sometimes call AGI, artificial general intelligence, but at the time was just, you know, AI as envisaged by the founders of the field like John McCarthy. So that's what I was doing. You know, that was what my PhD research was, and what my postdoctoral research was for quite a while after that. But then I abandoned that as a research paradigm quite a long time back. But when I was when I joined Cambridge, so I went to King's College in Cambridge, and my college played probably a bigger part in my life, you know, my social life, but my intellectual life too, I would say, than my department, than the faculty, the computer laboratory where I was, because suddenly, having come from Imperial, which is full of was and largely is full of, you know, scientists and engineers and so on, But suddenly I was surrounded in this very small collegiate setting by people with all kinds of intellectual interests. I was, you know, my friends were many of whom were undergraduates, because I was quite young as a PhD student, but my friends were all studying, you know, English or history or philosophy, of course. And so I took this as a spur to, you know, properly educate myself in many of those kind of spaces, but particularly philosophy. So I became very obsessed with philosophy as a you know, the actual proper discipline of philosophy, and I really spent I've often said that I spent more time on philosophy as a PhD student than I did on my actual PhD. I was going to every famous philosopher who came to give a talk at Cambridge, I'd be there. I was going to the Moral Sciences Club, which was the space in which famously Wittgenstein and Russell and all these people, all spoke at this little Moral Sciences Club, and it was very active at that time and still is. And I was going to every Moral Sciences Club meeting, and I was even going to undergraduate philosophy lectures. So I really got very heavily into philosophy at that time.
Yeah, throughout your career and life, it seems obvious that you've spent so much time pondering these deep, important questions that maybe a lot of people outside academia, I'm sure, think about, but not so much. What influence do you think this has had on like your own psychology, your outlook on life, your personal life? You know, thinking about these kind of ideas, can you think about that much?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question. So in some ways, I've taken a lot of pleasure in just pondering these questions. So I think the same pleasure that I took in pondering these questions as a kid, lying in my bed, looking up at the ceiling and imagining the stars, I really enjoyed that experience. Now at the same time, I think when I got into some pretty heavy philosophy, I could also find that quite disturbing as well. So sometimes, you get into quite disturbing territory if you're challenging the nature of reality, the nature of your mind. And so it's not entirely always pleasant, but by and large, I really enjoyed and still do enjoy thinking about these big philosophical questions. So that's been a big part of my life. But it also kind of does connect a little bit with my philosophical outlook does connect a little bit with Buddhism, actually. So I've always been very drawn to Buddhism, and particularly to Zen Buddhism, which I like the kind of critical in the philosophical sense of critical approach to metaphysical questions that you find in Zen Buddhism. And for me, I've long seen a kind of an affinity between Zen Buddhism and that kind of critical approach to philosophical questions you find in Zen Buddhism and the philosophy of Wittgenstein, the later philosophy of Wittgenstein. So they're kind of related to each other. So I guess that's an aspect of things for my life. It's a bit more personal as well.
Are there certain Buddhist principles or practices that you kind of follow and engage in?
Well, I'm an errant meditator. I've had periods in my life where I've meditated, pretty regularly and in a disciplined way, but then it lapses. But I think you do learn a kind of skill there of, detachment and relaxing your mind, which is a very, very beneficial skill. There's that, I guess.
And thinking a bit about the future now, can you speak about any of your plans at all, or any interesting work we're going to get a glimpse of? I think you've maybe got a new book coming out. Is it one thing I heard recently?
No, I'm not sure where you heard that from, but it's certainly something I would like to do. So it is. So there is no book in the in the immediate pipeline. But I definitely think that it's something I would like to do at some point. It would be to write another book on basically, philosophy in the current era of artificial intelligence. So I think this little mix of things: AI, Wittgenstein, Buddhism, contemporary AI, which I think can challenge a lot of our philosophical kind of concepts. I think a book that mixes all of those things together is probably brewing in the back of my mind, but there's no definite plan there. In the immediate future, I mean, I've got so I do have a recent paper called Simulacra as Conscious Exotica. So this concept of conscious exotica, which I've introduced, is quite an important concept in my thinking. So it's part of this idea of the space of possible minds. So if we ask the question, how is consciousness distributed through the space of possible minds, and what does it look like in that space? So we have to sort of want to grant the possibility of very strange forms of consciousness, but the Wittgensteinian in me wants to somewhat resist that. So the tension between the Wittgenstein inspired philosopher that wants to resist that and the natural intuition to feel that there are exotic forms of consciousness. So that's that tension is very interesting philosophically. So and I looked at that in this paper, Simulacra as Conscious Exotica, really thinking about contemporary generative AI and large language models. So that paper's, I mean, that's paper's been out for a little while, but I have a paper that's just about to appear actually, and probably by the time anybody listens to this podcast, that will be out, co-authored with Beth Singler, who is an anthropologist, on those conversations that we mentioned before with Claude from back in March 2024. And it's looking into the extraordinary range of images and metaphors and motifs and all the cornucopia of cultural references that come up in those conversations to do with all kinds of esoteric, spiritual and philosophical ideas, and trying to trace the genealogy of some of those ideas. So that's a big part of that paper. So that one's, it's called Existential Conversations with Large Language Models. So that'll be the next one.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Look forward to reading that paper. Just to go back to the previous paper that you talked about, Conscious Exotica, you say about these kind of tension between these two things. So what kind of conclusion do you come to in the paper, if one, about these two opposing ideas? Yeah,
I have sort of two papers with this phrase in the title. So there is one which is actually in Eon magazine from 2016. So that's an essay which is just called Conscious Exotica. And then the more recent one is Simulacra as Conscious Exotica, which is the one that's looking at large language models. Gosh, I've forgotten what your question was now.
You mentioned that in this paper you're addressing this tension.
Yeah, how does this... Okay. So in the first of those papers, I have a very dodgy diagram, which I know is and when I introduce this with talks, I have a philosophical health warning I pop up first. So I'm about to plot one philosophically dubious concept against another on a graph, and what I plot on the x-axis is capacity for consciousness, and what I plot on the y-axis is human likeness. And so I'm sort of, now I think this is very philosophically dubious, but it's an interesting provocative exercise. And so if you can sort of imagine that diagram, then you can imagine that on the bottom left-hand corner you've got bricks which are not human-like at all and have no capacity for consciousness, and then you've got humans which are somewhat up closer to the top right corner. We've got a high capacity for consciousness, and we're obviously 100% human-like because we are humans. But then the interesting question is, what else is on that diagram? And so we can imagine things that might have a high capacity for consciousness, whatever that means. And that's a whole controversial concept. But let's just take it as the some intuitive notion there, that might have some, high capacity for consciousness, but that are not very human-like. So those are the sort of conscious exotica. And so we might imagine that the octopus, we might want to put the octopus, somewhere there. And then we can imagine things that are a lot more alien, that might be, very hard to understand. And they're going to appear somewhere on that diagram, but they're going to be in a funny sort of region, which is low on human likeness, but high on capacity for consciousness. And then there's a whole region which I call the void of inscrutability. And that's because I don't think we can put anything in like the bottom right-hand corner of that diagram. So just to remind you what the bottom right-hand corner, so that's where you have high capacity for consciousness, but low human likeness. So these things are not like us at all, but they have a high capacity for consciousness. Now, our intuitions want to say that maybe there could be like really weird aliens, or like the sentient sea in Solaris, in the film Solaris, that are completely and utterly unlike us. But if only we knew, we'd see that they have this really alien weird form of consciousness. Now, the Wittgensteinian in me wants to reject the very idea and say that this is just, this is not something that we have the language to talk about. So it doesn't have a right to be on this diagram at all. So that's why the bottom right part of it is a void of inscrutability. There's nothing, there are no data points in that. It's a void, as far as I'm concerned. So that's how the tension sort of resolves itself, in this funny sort of way of saying that if things are that inaccessible to us or inscrutable to us, then our ordinary language is not applicable at all. It's not like there's some metaphysical fact of the matter that we are unable to access about their consciousness.
So you wouldn't deny that such things could possibly exist, it's just that we can't really discuss or imagine them with our language.
But that means that they don't exist. That means, or at least they, that means that, so in other words, if you have something that's inscrutably weird, then the language of consciousness just isn't applicable to it. So that's why it's a void of inscrutability. There's nothing in there. It's not like there's a weird alien things that are down in that bottom right-hand corner of my diagram. It's empty.
Okay. They might possibly exist in the sense that perhaps there's this other being with another kind of language that would be able to describe it and almost put them on their chart that we can't put in our chart. Would that count as a different kind of existence?
That's a great, really great question. Then the question is there if we draw another diagram that had, weird, not human-like language, plotted against something, then that might give us another void of inscrutability, because maybe describing it as language wouldn't be quite the right thing, given our language. I mean, it's a really fascinating question. Wittgenstein famously says, if a lion could speak, we would not understand him. And now, I've never really much liked that particular Wittgenstein quote, because I do feel that actually a lion is something we have a lot in common with. We share a lot of our form of life with a lion. Now, a lion is a fellow mammal, and it has to eat and crap and reproduce and protect itself and so on. And so we share a great deal with lions. So I think we'd have quite a bit to talk about comparatively, whereas the sorts of things we're imagining here would have to be, so very different that we'd have very little point of contact with them. So maybe language wouldn't, maybe we wouldn't even call it language. It would be some other kind of dynamical interaction between these things. And if we were studying them as sort of anthropologists or scientists, we might have to invent our own terms, but they wouldn't enable us to communicate with them.
Don't know if you know, but I actually ask every guest the same question to end an episode. Feels like quite an apt one given your philosophical interest. So final question, Murray, is what do you think it means to live a good life?
I think it depends on what it means for you to live a good life. So each individual person has to find their own, what is meaningful in life for them. And so for me, to live a good life means partly to pursue these kind of academic, scholarly interests, and they're a profound part of my life. But also, I have a family. I have a wife and two children, and that's certainly been an important part of a meaningful life for me. I think other things that that constitute a meaningful life for me are also things like travel. I really get a great deal out of travel and have done in my life. I think that's been a very mind-expanding thing for me. And spending time in nature, and with animals when possible. Those things contribute, I think, hugely to leading a meaningful life.
Well, thank you so much. That's been very interesting. Great to hear about your life and work. And yeah, I look forward to seeing some of these, this new paper you talked about, and maybe even a book at one point in the future.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. And I hope to see you here again.